your farm, and your future matter to us. Welcome to Dairy Stream, a podcast focusing on opportunities and challenges impacting the future of dairy. This podcast is brought to you by the Dairy Business Association and Edge Dairy Farmer Cooperative, sister organizations fighting for sensible dairy policy in Wisconsin and Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Joanna Guza. Unmanned aerial vehicles, or UAVs, are playing a role in precision agriculture. Today, we will cover the most popular UAVs, scouting crops, interpreting data, challenges, economics, and safety. I am joined with Dr. Brian Luck. He is an associate professor and extension specialist in biological systems engineering at UW-Madison. Dr. Brian Luck's field of interest include machine management, variable rate technology, agricultural big data management, and remote sensing. In this first part, we're going to cover the basics of UAVs and their capabilities. And then after the break, we will talk about the economics and safety. Well, Dr. Luck, to get started, how are unmanned aerial vehicles being used in precision agriculture? And are we just talking about drones?
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's an interesting question. So since I started at the University of Wisconsin-Madison in about 2014, that's when we first got our, initial look at the unmanned aerial vehicles, or what people are calling drones, around agriculture. So basically, quite a bit of progress that's happened in that last decade since we had our first little, whatever the first one was, the DJI Phantom of some sort. Those are still out there. But we're moving from just remote sensing visible light cameras that were available at that time to a lot of other things now. So we're looking at sprayer spreader drones that'll apply crop inputs during the growing season. We're looking at those same drones that'll do cover crop planting in the fall into a standing crop. So there's a lot of progress we've made in the last 10 years. How they're being used is kind of an interesting question to me, because we are seeing some excitement around these sprayer spreader drones, quite a bit actually. So if you look at, I just got back from a talk in Minnesota. I was with some weed scientists. Those kind of crop inputs that require a large volume of water, if we're talking about a sprayer drone, probably not the best application for those. But we can do things like fungicides and smaller volumetric applications that might get us into fields where a ground rig won't work. Mm-hmm. On the other side, if we're looking at remote sensing, there's a couple of ways they're being used from a research standpoint, and more of your, let's call it advanced crop consultants. Some of that remote sensing data is able to go into ag software. The most basic and what we've heard about for years is the normalized difference vegetative index, so NDVI. That's just an indicator of how much green is present in the plant. And that's a real basic way of saying it. There's more of it, more to it than that. But generally, that's how much green is present. So it works well. If we're kind of looking at corn in a nitrogen situation, you know, we can start seeing yellowing in that corn and be able to detect that really easily. The other thing that I find really interesting, and I've had a lot of conversations with crop consultants that have invested in these, is I say it a little tongue in cheek here, but used to every crop consultant would go out to the field in Wisconsin and walk a W through the field, you know, and everybody in Minnesota would walk an M, and they both find different things. So if you can use that UAV before you go into a field, send it up, you know, 150 feet, 200 feet, and take just a visible light overview of that field, you might be able to see something quickly that says, I need to go there. Something's going on there, but I don't know what it is. So I need to walk in that direction. It may fall in that W or it may not, right? So I think the most application we've seen to this point is quite literally that. Crop consultants going into the field and sending them up just to get an overview before they walk out and try to do any diagnosis of what's going on.
We'll get more into specifics with scouting crops. And I want to first, before we get to that, what has been the most popular? I mean, you referenced drones or that UAV. Is there a certain brand that you've seen people utilizing that's maybe more affordable? And then you said it's probably most popularly used for scouting crops. But want to get your insight on what's been the most popular like piece of equipment you've worked with.
Yeah, it's a great question. So as far as most popular, I think the DJI products have been kind of the most that I've seen out there. You can get anything from that company, from a small kind of hold it in the palm of your hand size, all the way up to the big sprayer spreader types that we've been talking about. They have a full sort of line. There are other companies out there. I haven't had the pleasure of working with them. We did have a fixed wing as well. So, you know, if we get outside of the little helicopters, there was a company that shared with us a automated fixed wing, and it's a very interesting machine. So I'll spend just a second, but it's a vertical takeoff and landing. So it kind of works like a quadcopter when it takes off, but it looks more like an airplane. So basically when it takes off straight up and down, and then you put in your flight plan or whatever you want to call it, goes up to about 150, 200 feet, turns sideways, and then flies like an airplane. It is able to fly quite a bit faster than the little helicopters that we're used to seeing, and cover a lot more ground as well. So that's another interesting sort of application for those type of machines, to be able to get over, let's say, 50, 100 acres in a single flight, compared to the quadcopters that can cover, you know, maybe 20, 30, 40 at the most, depending on how high you are.
Right. We're going to see a lot of, I think, innovation in this area. So we're excited to be covering it now and having you on Dairy Stream. And you kind of gave us a taste of this already, but how are UAVs used to scout crops, and what kind of data are they collecting?
Yeah, we'll cover a little of the same ground, but I have some thoughts too. So I guess the first thing we'll go over is the take in the general picture, right? So that's where I've seen them being used the most. If you send one up, just take an overview. I have slides that I use all the time that you can kind of see where the planter started and stopped. You can see, you know, maybe some areas that are lacking in nitrogen for whatever reason in a cornfield that's probably at R1, R2, getting around tassel stage. So being able to get an overview is a great thing. If you're using one of those little quadcopters, the other option that you have, albeit we'll get into rules later, but maintaining line of sight, you can bring it down closer to the crop and get a look at what's going on. Dealing with prop wash and moving leaves and everything else is a whole nother issue. But if you did see an area out there that you wanted to get a little better idea of what was going on, you can bring it down right to the level of the crop and get a really close picture. So that's sort of the first thing. If we look at remote sensing, so being able to use sort of the NDVIs, the different wavelengths that are coming off the crop, I have seen a little bit of that going on. Some people have it just, you know, it's on the machine that they purchase. So they use it and they bring it into their ag management software, whatever that would be, to get an overview of the field as well. A little bit of that has to come with post-processing. There are some companies out there that do it quickly and can get it back down to your iPad or whatever device you're using, you know, within minutes. And that could be a lower resolution than what you would get, say, if you give it time to process for several hours, but you get a general idea of the results of that before you go out in the field. One of the things I'm kind of excited about, and that we've noticed in some of our work, we've been using UAVs to kind of try to quantify alfalfa damage from wheel traffic on tires. The work that we've done is we run over the alfalfa in different scenarios, either different tire pressures or different timing, simulating hay harvest or silage harvest. And then we come back and fly it 10 days after it had been, you know, received the treatment. We're starting to be able to see those differences in the amount of regrowth in that alfalfa that, you know, we see in our NDVI data that you wouldn't necessarily be able to see with the naked eye. So being able to understand how much damage is in your field, and then we're working to sort of back calculate, does that mean more leaves, less stems, more stems, less leaves, you know, what does that mean to the alfalfa plant? And I'm working with our forage agroecologist, Dr. Coleman, here to kind of get at that. But we are able to see that we're damaging the plants, and there's less regrowth on the plants that were run over by machines. So it's kind of a interesting thing. And now that I know we can do it, we need to tell the farmers and the crop consultants, you know, what that means to management in the end, which I believe is run over less alfalfa, but we'll get to that soon. Right. There's another side of it as well, where we're looking from a research standpoint. So there are sensors called hyperspectral sensors. So we have our NDVI, which is usually four or five wavelengths in that red, green, blue, infrared, near infrared, red edge sort of wavelengths. This hyperspectral sensor, you know, goes across the whole spectrum. So ultraviolet all the way to infrared or close to infrared. And there's a lot more wavelengths and other things we can do with that. So we've had some experience in the past, again, in alfalfa, where we're able to estimate, I'll use the word estimate, with some degree of accuracy, the yield that's out there using those sensors. And we've also been able to sort of estimate the quality of the alfalfa, the feed quality. So if you think about it, you know, we have the visible light is here now, able to be used really, really easily, gets down to your phone quickly, good for crop scouting. Some of the NDVI, the vegetative indices sensors, same thing, easy to get it down your phone quickly. It's here now for crop consulting. That hyperspectral sensor, I would say, is probably 10 years out before it's anywhere near affordable. And it probably won't be the full hyperspectral spectrum in my estimation. We are using that to identify specific wavelengths within the light spectrum that we would build a smaller, cheaper sensor to look at this specific thing in this specific crop.
Dr. Luck, I know a lot of these farmers are saying, I'm going to leave you to the research aspect of it because I could tell that you know a lot about it. But let's talk more about that interpreting the data. But let's talk about from that farmer or that crop consultant perspective. You know, I think sometimes this is really great technology, but we're getting bombarded with so much information. Is there any tools that it comes in through a software that helps them analyze and kind of get that big picture? Or when they go over and they, you know, see a deficiency, how would you walk them through what to do next?
Yeah, so sort of the workflow is what you're asking. I guess we'll start with the most basic. You put your UAV up in the air, right? And there's generally, I'll say, you know, with I know you have a farmer audience here. I don't see farmers generally owning the UAV. They would benefit from it, but it's usually, I think, the justification in the investment for the amount of acres you have and the value of the data probably isn't there for the farmer. But if you're working with a crop consultant, that's sort of where it comes in, is they have it, they can get it over more acres. So put your UAV up in the air, collect the data, whatever that looks like. It can be high flights that the resolution is still going to be much higher than what we can get out of satellite data because you're, you know, anywhere from 150 to 200 feet above the crop. What that'll do as it's flying is usually you can program in based on the GPS receiver on the UAV, which can be any number of things. It can be a WAAS enabled, you know, plus or minus 10 feet accuracy, which is good enough in all honesty, all the way up to RTK on these things. So you can get sub inch accuracy on the location of the UAV and on the location of your images. So based on that, we have that GPS data. It'll tell you tell the UAV how often to take a picture. Once it takes that picture, then you program in some sort of overlap with the UAV that will allow a lot of similar things in the same image to be in the two or three different pictures. And then the software on the back end will stitch, what we call stitch, all that together. So it makes one big picture out of hundreds, generally, depending on how many acres you're going over. Some of that relies on ground reference points too. So if you're collecting data over field and you need to be very accurate about where things are in that field, you generally put down what we call ground control points, which are just black and white targets on the ground. And then you put those in a known location. You know, we usually survey those in. Most people won't get to that depth of control, I don't think. Usually it's more of a, I know where this light pole is, so I can line things up that way, right? So all that generally goes to an SD card, can be transferred to some sort of server or whatever to get all that stitching done. And then you bring it back down to your ag management software. Tons of those out there. Ag Leader SMS, Deer has one. There's, you know, quite a few different softwares out there, but that will sort of display the image. When we're looking at the sensors we have today, basically what we're getting is a something's wrong reading. And if you're on the research side, you know, we kind of know what damage we did if we're doing damage, right? So I can sort of attribute it to what I did, and I did it on purpose. If you're looking at just a general field, we can identify that something's wrong area. If it's, you know, pretty, it can be pretty obvious when you my example I always go back to is nitrogen in corn. If corn doesn't have enough nitrogen, it'll yellow, it's obvious that what that is. But when we're talking about diseases and, you know, other deficient nutrient input deficiencies, it may not be that obvious. So generally what I say is that if we're using these sensors, visible light all the way to vegetative indices, whatever, today, as we sit here, you're still going to have to walk out into the field and have somebody knowledgeable look and say, this is the area I saw that was a problem. What is the problem? You know, it could be any number of things. So I think that collecting the data, the workflow there, again, lends itself well to the crop consultant side compared to generally the farmer. Now, I know there are some farmers out there shaking their fist at me saying, I do it every day. That's fine. There are some advanced farmers that do it and use it. And I love that. Interpreting that data in the end, like I said, is going to be more of a, I still have to go look usually to see what it is. Now, when we get into that hyperspectral stuff that's coming down the road, those sensors could be tailored to a very specific, what are we trying to assess and what are we trying to detect? But I think we're still a few years out from that. So most of that interpretation comes down to it's a more precise, I know where to go look. I know where things are wrong. I can go check that and see what management strategies I can use to minimize the effects of whatever's going on out in our fields.
A few terms that you've used is remote sensing and thermal imagery. Can you explain what those are and then how they're being used?
Remote sensing is basically, and thermal imagery falls under this as well, basically collecting reflected light at its most basic definition. When we look at these sensors, if you look on the UAVs and how they sort of work, there's two different types. There's active sensors and passive sensors from a remote sensing standpoint. So when I talk about active sensors, basically what I'm saying is it has its own light source. So you put the sensor over the crop, it turns on its little light, and basically it's shining its known amount of light on on whatever the subject is, and it collects some data. The passive sensors, however, use the sun's light to be able to get that reflectance. Very interesting conversation there, because our sun doesn't always shine the same amount of light throughout the day, even hour to hour. So what you have to do is you have to have what's called a downwelling light sensor. So it's just a sensor that looks up at the sun and says, this much light is coming down. And then the vegetative indices sensor looks down and said, this much light's coming back. And there's some math magic done behind the scenes to be able to correct for that. That said, it's not a foolproof system. So you really would prefer the same amount of light to be coming down every time you use that sensor. And so what the recommendations generally are on those sensors is you fly during, I'm doing air quotes here, solar noon. So what that means is you start at 11 a.m. and you quit at 2 p.m. And so during that time, the sun is as close to directly overhead as it can be during that part of the year whenever you're flying. It reduces shadows. So if the sun's coming straight down, that's a helpful thing to get as many shadows out of the image as you can, and then be able to take a reading and those readings be consistent throughout your data. From a remote sensing and a light reflectance standpoint, that's how that works. Thermal imagery, on the other hand, it's been a while since I've been in my heat transfer class, but it's more of an emitting thing. So you're measuring heat. A lot of people have the little trigger guns that we keep in our kitchen or around our shop to be able to point it at, say, the oil that we're fixing to cook something in and understand how warm that oil is, or if we're measuring exhaust temperatures or whatever. That's very much a single thermal sensor. Well, what we've done is we've created a camera with those same type of sensors as well. Technically, they should be quote unquote calibrated or similarly assessed to what I described before with the reflectance data as well. There's something called a black body that you basically paint something very matte black and measure its temperature with that thermal, and then measure its temperature with something that you trust, a thermometer that you trust, and that'll get you a calibration to measure very accurate temperature. Most people don't do that when they're using a thermal sensor. And so it winds up being more relative data, right? So when I use my thermal camera and I fly it and I do not use a black body, what you wind up getting is more or less a relative temperature difference out there. So one of the interesting things, you know, with thermal that we've talked about is plants are obviously living and they respire and try to cool themselves in different ways. And if you're able to use the thermal imagery to say one area of the field is hotter than the other, you may be able to correlate that directly to something going on in the field. It could be, you know, lack of water, could be disease, could be, you know, again, we don't really have a silver bullet on any of these sensors that exist today to tell us what's wrong. But they are really good diagnostic tools to tell us something's wrong, and very similar for the thermal imagery. There are some thoughts out there. I haven't seen a lot of thermal, you know, being shouted from the rooftops that this is the best and new sensor out there that we should have, and, you know, everybody should go buy one. We're still kind of in the infancy stages from what I've heard and read in the literature about what we even use them for. Again, something's wrong, but we don't know what. There's a couple of papers that I've read too that were interesting to me, looking at dry down of plants at harvest. So, you know, as those plants, I don't know if senesce is the right word, but die off and they're starting to get to a certain, we want them to get to a certain moisture content before we harvest them, you may be able to get at some of that information with a thermal camera more easily. So that's an interesting application that we're kind of talking about here as well, looking at corn silage and some other things to be able to use that for.
And before we jump into our break, I'll ask, when is the best time to be scouting our crops and using UAVs? But first, I'd like you to share, and you kind of alluded to some of these challenges, but what are some challenges when it comes to UAVs?
The first thing I'll say, I'm a machinery guy by training. I enjoy machinery quite a bit. The first thing, it's just like any other machine, there's maintenance required with some of these devices. One of the things that we've experienced having utilize these pieces of machinery for nearly a decade now is batteries don't last forever. And so, you know, you purchase the UAV, you get this little battery with it, and a lot of people just use it and go, and then charge it, use it and go, charge it, use it and go. We have a UAV extension kind of blog post on our website, and we sort of look through a lot of company materials on some of these UAVs, and they basically recommend, you know, 100 or so flights, maybe a few more than that on a battery, and it probably should be retired. So it's one of those things, if you think about it, when you put that thing up in the air, you know, a lot of those batteries, they discharge differently as they age, and they may discharge more quickly. So you're used to being able to fly that UAV, again, 100 feet above the crop, maybe more, for 20 minutes. But as you keep using those batteries, that 20 minutes becomes 18, becomes 16, becomes 15. Usually they have a sensor on there to measure that battery voltage, battery outputs, and it will say, oh no, I'm running low, I need to come home, kind of thing. And, you know, maybe it's way too far away from you to come home, and then you have to go hunt for it in the middle of a cornfield. So it's one of those things that I think that would be the biggest challenge, is maintenance, maintaining those batteries, making sure the batteries are, we'll call it, up to snuff or fresh or whatever you want to call it. The props are very similar. So the little props on the smaller UAVs, you know, any kind of insect that they hit could be enough damage to make them not work well. And that could eat at your battery life as well. So, you know, keeping track of the maintenance on them is a big thing. And understanding, you know, as things age, especially batteries and props and other things, keeping track of how many times you use that battery and then saying, okay, it's probably time to replace that, just so I don't drop my $2,000+ little sensor out in the middle of somewhere I can't find it, right? So that's one of the challenges. The other challenge too is just, and we'll get into the rules and regulations later, but understanding where you can fly and the capabilities, the software and the controls of these things is amazing, actually. I mean, it's basically, if I can do it, anybody can do it, right? Like I played video games a little bit as a kid, but you know, they're really easy to operate. So you tend to start trusting them, in my opinion, a little too much. And I've had a few graduate students put a little more trust in them than I do. And then you get in a situation to where maybe something like they have little compasses in them and little electronics that all have to be sort of in the right state of mind, for lack of a better way of putting it, to fly correctly if you're flying them autonomously. And on occasion, they don't have a good way of telling you that, I don't know, something's not exactly right. And then you put it up in the air and it says, uh-oh, and it starts flying towards, you know, California in the middle of Wisconsin, and you got to stop it and get it home. You know, it makes up its mind to do whatever it wants, right? And so we've had a couple of them come down, I would say uneventfully, thank heavens.
Right.
But on occasion, you know, there's some other stories I could tell I won't bring up here that wasn't so uneventful when they came down. So yeah, just again, it's maintenance and keeping track of how they work. Really quickly, as far as when to scout, you know, it's typical crop scouting time. You know, whenever you're looking for something, and we have a lot of stuff at UW Extension that, you know, from the disease standpoint, there's some apps out there, you know, Tar Spotter and Sporecaster that Dr. Smith puts out that can tell you when you're looking for white mold in soybeans or tar spot in corn. That's when you would take your UAV out with you to spot for those and decide whether to spray or not. Similar things in insect time. You know, Dr. Bick is looking at corn rootworm and some other things. There's a time of year that happens. So that's when you would want to go out. You're going to be out there looking anyway. Maybe the UAV can tell you activities are happening in other one spot versus another, and that's when you would go.
Dr. Brian Luck has been our guest, and next we will cover economics, rules, and safety. But first, let's hear from our Dairy Stream sponsor.
The Nature Conservancy is a global conservation organization dedicated to conserving the lands and waters on which all life depends. Guided by science, TNC helps farmers improve soil health and protect clean water while sustaining profitability. The organization is also a partner in the Dairy Feed in Focus program, an industry-led effort designed to help dairy farmers adopt climate-smart agriculture practices. To learn more, visit nature.org/Wisconsin.
Dairy Stream is brought to you by the Dairy Business Association and Edge Dairy Farmer Cooperative. In the second part, we're going to talk about economics, rules, and safety. What are some of the economics behind utilizing a UAV versus alternatives?
I'm an engineer by training, so not an economist. I'll say that right up front. I think they will speak to the efficiency of crop scouting. So if you look out, you're going to go out there and, like I said at the beginning, walk that W through the field, or you're going to put up a UAV for 10 minutes, take a picture and understand where you need to go and what you need to do. That makes you more efficient. If you don't see any problems, yeah, you walk the W, you go see if you can find something. But if you do, you know you need to go to that spot and see what needs to be addressed. The other side of it, which we haven't talked about a whole lot yet, is that spinner spreader UAV that sprays and spreads cover crops. I've heard, I don't have a very big sample size here, but the conversations I have had, it's about $20 an acre to have something flown on with a UAV from the companies that are kind of out there today. That may have changed a bit, you know, plus or minus a couple of dollars, but we're looking at $20 an acre, and that's not counting the product that you're applying. So that's just the UAV. The product is on top of that. That's quite a bit more than what a ground rig would cost to get a co-op to come out and spray, spread, or do something in your field during the growing season. Couple of things there that I don't have any numbers to put to, but we are looking at, you know, if you're flying something on, you're not running over plants that are causing damage with that ground rig going out there. So that may be an interesting concept at some point. We're talking about the value of the plant, and as long as it stays there, it's very valuable, then maybe that's worth flying over. Some other things to consider with those sprayer spreader UAVs is, you know, you might have fields that are really oddly shaped that, you know, a large ground rig has to turn around more than it actually has to spray. Areas that the ground rig can't get to, the areas that the crop dusters, airplanes can't get to very easily, that it suits itself very well to using that UAV. You know, based on that, you kind of have to make a decision on if you need to apply X, you know, and it has to go out there. Is that $20 an acre, you know, sort of worth the application and saving the plants from being run over? And again, that's an economics question that I don't have an answer to, but in the end, I'm sure there are, you know, justification one way or the other. And especially if you can't get to the field and it's, you know, a field you're trying to rescue application, something out there to keep your yield, it might be worth the investment.
Right. The economics are going to depend on the situation and what you have going on. And it seems like more people are doing more research behind that. One item that you brought up is the importance of understanding the rules. Well, what rules do farms need to follow with UAVs?
How much time do you have? I'm sorry. The rules are pretty straightforward. So it depends on how you're operating. And the FAA websites, Drone Zone, et cetera, are all very explanatory, but I'll hit the high points here. If you're flying commercially, which means basically, I'll go ahead and say it, anything to do with a farm and a farmer field is going to fall under commercial flying. If you're flying commercially, then you have to have a Part 107 pilot's license. All that is an online test that you have to take that makes sure you understand the public airspace. When you talk about, the easiest example is airports. There is a no-go zone kind of in the shape of an upside down birthday cake, if you want to visualize it, around that airport. And so the reason for that being is that 20 miles out, and I'm making these numbers up, it may be further than that, I'm not a pilot, you know, you're at a certain altitude. As you get closer to that airport, you're going to be losing altitude to be able to land or take off in whichever case you may be in. 20 miles out, it may be 500 feet, 600 feet up in the air or higher, that is kind of the no-go zone. As you get to 10 miles, it may come down to 300, 400 feet. 5 miles could be 200 feet. And then at the airport, it's all the way to ground level. Understanding that and all of the other implications within the airspace, what they're trying to do is make sure folks that are flying these things commercially understand where airplanes are and how to avoid them. When we're out in the middle of nowhere, you know, usually the airplanes are going to be way up in the air and it's generally no problem. There is a hard ceiling on the UAVs, and I believe it's 400 feet. So you're not supposed to go higher than 400 feet ever. If you've ever flown a relatively small UAV, and I've seen it done and done it myself, 400 feet's way up there. And, you know, it turns into a little bitty speck that you can't really see or tell where it is, as long as you're looking sort of at your camera and your camera's giving you feedback as to where the UAV is. So you need the Part 107 license, study a little bit. It's not a very difficult test. It's just making sure you understand where airplanes are and how to avoid them. With the small UAVs beyond that, you're okay, other than you have to register it, which it's, you know, a $5 registration online. You put in the serial number of the UAV and put your name on it, so that if it ever does get into a situation where that is found in a issue or area where you lost it, you know, they can trace it back to you and reprimand you or whatever for doing something you weren't supposed to be doing. And then finally, there's a new rule coming out soon, which was supposed to be implemented last fall, and they pushed it back. But UAVs are supposed to have a transponder on them that broadcasts a over the radio waves, I am here kind of message. And those can be picked up by pilots and others to understand, you know, it does show up on their little radar systems and say, you know, I'm here, don't run into me kind of thing. So it's just another safety aspect. Most of the new ones you buy today will have that built in. If you have an older one, like I do, you're going to have to go purchase one of those transponders and hook it into your UAV, which is not a hard task, but it just basically, it's another safety tool. Talking about rules, moving to the sprayer UAVs. So everything I've talked about to this point is 55 pounds or less. Those spreader UAVs get north of 100 pretty quickly. So now we're above that 55 pound rule. There's going to be an exemption needed for the UAV be flown through the FAA. Most of the time, as it stands, where you purchase that UAV from has the exemptions, and they will be able to amend their exemption to include your UAV in that list so that the FAA knows it's out there and what it's doing. They do that for a certain amount of time, and you are supposed to go on and fill out your own form, because the time it takes to get those done and through the FAA and approved is pretty long right now, because there's a lot of them out there. So being able to use an amended exemption for a while until you get your own approval and your own exemption is a good thing. So that's one thing. You still need the Part 107. And then rules in Wisconsin are that you need a aerial applicator's license through, I think it's DATCAP and UW Extension that run that program. So basically you have to go through the training to be able to understand how to spray, what to spray, a lot of things, consideration, wind, et cetera, that you have to think about when spraying chemicals on ag fields and public safety and things like that. So environmental safety. So you do need both of those. You'll have to have the Part 107, the exemption, and I say both, all three, chemical applicators license for aerial applications to be able to use those properly and be legal. I say all this just to warn you a little bit as well, because the fines for the FAA are pretty steep, you know, $10,000+ if you're caught doing something wrong. So I don't want to get into doom and gloom. This is a very exciting product that I think we all should consider using as we go forward. I just want to make sure you understand that, you know, if something is out of line, there are real repercussions for doing it. We want to make sure we're all legal and the way we should be, because we don't want to get this tool taken away from us. If you're thinking about this, make sure you go to some of the FAA's website. They're easy to find, easy to Google, and get in there and read and make sure you understand what licensure you need to do what you want to do to be legal, to avoid those fines and stuff.
You've talked a little bit about safety, but are there any other safety considerations we have to know with UAVs?
It's just like any other piece of equipment. There's rotating sharp things, which is, you know, sort of the first thing to consider when that thing's taken off. I've been around the little palm sized ones all the way up to the sprayer spreaders, and every one of them is a little disconcerting when it goes. Like, you're talking weed eater situation there, which is, you know, pretty intense. So taking off and landing, you know, a lot of people have these little mats they put out to be able to take off and land from, avoid the grass around there, try not to get the props in the grass. All that's generally for the safety of the UAV. But again, if you were to take off in a grassy area and one of those props got slowed down when it took off, you know, that can go any direction in that case and fly right into you. So something to be aware of. I'm guilty of this as well, as catching them out of the sky. They're so controllable, these quadcopters, that you can hover them at a really nice level and, you know, sort of think about catching them and turning them off. I would recommend not doing that, because one slip of whatever, and you get a finger or a hand or any part of skin up into those little props, and it can be a major problem. So I would avoid that. The other thing I'll bring up too is something we don't think about. If you think about power lines and anything out there that you're flying around, can be an issue. And the UAVs, a lot of them have these forward-looking proximity sensors that are supposed to detect something when they're about to hit it. And, you know, trees, it works pretty well. Barns, it works pretty well. Power lines, those are hard to see for that sensor. So that's another thing just to think about too, is if you're around power lines, you know, that autonomous flight might not be the best idea. Controlling it yourself, maybe walking with it a little bit to make sure you're clear of those power lines and other things that are obstacles in the way is something else. The last safety thing I'll touch on is these things aren't light. Even the little bitty ones, you know, if they're coming in to a landing and coming in pretty fast and they lose power, it's a projectile, and when it hits something, it's going to make a dent, if not worse. So hitting yourself, hitting a vehicle, anything like that could be dangerous. So I would say just making sure the thing's under control all the time. And sort of back to our rules that I didn't bring up, it always requires a line of sight to the UAV. So making sure that you're not flying it around corners and fields, you know, kind of on the backside of the woods where you can't see it. You're always supposed to be able to see the UAV and see what it's doing at all times. There's just a few safety things that the FAA has put in place, in my opinion, are basically common sense that, you know, we should be doing and taking care to make sure these things don't come falling out of the sky and cause some major issues.
Two more questions as we wrap up this Dairy Stream episode. How do we protect our farm's data? I mean, we're going up there, we're capturing all this information. And is there any questions we should be asking? Like, you made a comment, most farmers might not be using a drone. They might be working with their crop consultant. Is there anything we should make sure that is just aware that we're not just sending this data, or even cybersecurity and people hacking into that and getting information about our food supply? And I know this might be subjective a little bit, but just curious about your take on how we should be protecting our data.
Yeah, I'll try not to put on my tinfoil hat too much here, but As far as your farm's data, and it's a whole nother conversation that we could have, you know, a whole podcast on, but I'll be brief, is it's all about trusted advisors. Anybody that you're working with, whether it be a co-op, whether it be a crop consultant, whether it be a machinery company, should have a, what we'll call a terms of use agreement on any product that you do. And within that, I know how many of us actually read those. The vast majority say, accept and move on. But if you were to read that, there should be some sort of statement in there talking about data security, data sharing. And understanding that is not the worst thing for our farmers to do. And I, you know, I'll admit Google runs my life. My phone dings at me and, you know, does all sorts of silly stuff to make me show up where I'm supposed to show up and do what I'm supposed to do when I'm supposed to do it. I sort of let them have it. But when it comes to your livelihood, it might be better to spend a little time looking at those, right? And just sort of understand, you know, will they share this data within the co-op? Are they going to aggregate my data with other farmers' data and use it for some sort of analysis? I say all of that as a good thing, by the way. Right. I think aggregating you and your neighbor's data and all this, you know, within co-ops or within regions or within companies even, I don't think that's a bad thing. If we're talking about, you know, statistics and decision making and farming, you know, the rule is the higher the N, the lower the error, which means more data points that I can get means I'm more confident in my analysis, right? So I don't think that's a bad thing. There's a Purdue Crop Life Survey that comes out every year. Dr. Erickson and Dr. Loewenberg DeBoer do that. I would say go look at that too. If you look at some of the data that they're collecting from the ag machinery dealerships and the co-ops, you know, a lot of those are collecting data within their customer group, aggregating that data and providing better information back to their growers on this is happening now. This is, you know, whatever, could be disease, could be nitrogen, nutrient management, et cetera. All that's going back out. And I think that's a good thing. But I would, as a farmer, want to understand that's happening and making sure that I'm okay with it. Another aspect of it is a lot of our data goes to a server somewhere and we don't know where that is. So I talked about stitching, you know, sort of stitching the data together and making these large, nice images that I can display in my ag management software and look at all of this. You know, understanding what company has that data, again, the terms of use, the licensing agreement, whether or not that data is, I own that data, or once I transfer it to the server, they consider it as they own that data, may help you make a decision on whether to invest in such a software, right? So I don't think we all need to become lawyers necessarily and understand those agreements, but a quick read on occasion doesn't hurt a thing. Just so you understand what your data is being used for and does it benefit you or does it benefit the company in the end? You know, again, if we all make the joke, if you talk about wanting to buy a certain pair of shoes and then all of a sudden your phone shows you 6 advertisements for those shoes, we've all seen that, right? Mm-hmm. Stuff's listening to us all the time. To me, it doesn't bother me because I want the cheapest, nicest pair of shoes I can buy. But when it comes to ag data, that's a little different animal. So like I said, I don't think it's a protection issue necessarily. Now, in the future, cybersecurity and all sorts of other things, there's a lot smarter people than I am working on that and trying to prevent it. And I'm happy for that. But at very least, understanding where your data is and the reach that your data has is not a bad thing to do as a farmer today, I think.
So last question, what makes you excited about, you know, precision technology and what future trends are you keeping an eye on?
In terms of UAVs, and this sort of exists, I don't know how cost effective it is. If we talk about this crop scouting thing, there are UAV systems out there that are 100% autonomous that live in the field. So we put a little black box next to the field. The UAV can land and take off from this box. It has an internet connection. You know, it could be situated with its own little weather sensor there, you know, blah, blah, blah. Every day at the same time, my little UAV goes up, goes out, flies my field, comes back and lands, transfers that data. We're capable today to collect more information about our crops than we ever have been before. Now, actionable data. That's a whole nother debate that I won't get into right now, but at very least we can collect a lot of data about that crop. And then as we collect more and more of that data, not only on one field, but multiple fields all the way across the country, similar soil types, similar weather patterns, dissimilar soil types, dissimilar weather patterns, put all that into this system, and we may be able to predict disease outbreaks and insect infestations. And the part that excites me is not controlling crop issues on a landscape scale, but controlling it on a by acre, less than an acre, quarter acre, third of it, you know, being able to run out there and say, I've got this problem right here, and if I take care of it now, it won't go anywhere else in my field, is just amazing to me, right? That saves money on inputs. It saves money on time. It saves the environment because we're not spraying these chemicals all across. If you don't need to spray it across the field, no farmer will, right? Because it costs X dollars an acre to go across. But if I can just treat this area, solve the problem, off we go. It's a great thing. So I think the UAVs feed into the data, which feeds into the decision-making, which feeds into precision agriculture, which is, I don't know if you can tell I get excited about this stuff, but I do. And it has the potential to be an exciting, and, you know, the production of food could be very well managed as we go forward, which I'm very much looking forward to.
Right. There's so much opportunity. And Dr. Brian Luck, we appreciate your time and sharing your expertise and experiences here on Dairy Stream. I also want to make sure that I thank our listeners for tuning in. You can always send me topic ideas by emailing podcast@dairyforward.com. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm your host, Joanna Guza, for Dairy Stream. The Dairy Business Association and Edge Dairy Farmer Cooperative would like to thank you for listening to Dairy Stream. If you enjoyed our podcast, please subscribe and rate Dairy Stream. We value your feedback, and if there's something you'd like to hear, email us at podcast@dairyforward.com.